Pleasure to welcome Rabbi Yoni Rosenzweig. Rabbi Rosenzweig is the rabbi of the Netzach Menashe community in Beit Shemesh. He's also the founder in 2020 of the Magalei Nefesh Halacha community in mental health. He wrote a sefer recently, Nafshi B'Sheilati, on halachic questions dealing with mental health. And it's a pleasure to welcome here to speak on the halachic aspects of mental health. Bakasha Rabbi Yoni.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. And yes, I will dive straight into our topic, as our time is short. What I'll do is I'll give you like a really quick introduction, what it is that I do within my organization, just so that you understand kind of like the background for this entire topic. So mental health has halachic ramifications as well. And that's even without the war, right? Even without the war, without anything that has to do with that, we have to understand that people who are dealing with mental health challenges have many shilas, many questions that come up. Today, for example, I was asked by someone with OCD whether she has to worry about Lashon Hara because her OCD causes her to worry every moment that she may be speaking about something that is problematic halachically. And that causes her great strife and the inability to really talk about anyone or anything with anyone. And you can imagine how difficult that is for someone with OCD, or someone with depression, who many times alleviates that depression by listening to music, and on Shabbat can't do so, right? So you can imagine how difficult, you know, that might be for an individual, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, people who go through mental health challenges, have shilas, have questions. Now you might think, okay, so then rabbis answer questions that have to do with mental health and halacha. And that's true. But it's more than just answering a question. What you really need to understand is that when rabbis answer questions that have to do with mental health in a halachic way, what they're doing, the important work that they're doing, is that they're giving place and a reality to that person, and a presence to that person, so that they feel that they are not transparent, so that they feel, people can't hear me properly.
We can hear you. Your voice does go in and out a little bit. I don't know if it's the internet connection or you're not always speaking next to the mic, but hear you, but it's a little inconsistent. So I don't know what I can do from our end, but maybe just be closer to the mic, but okay. But
let me try. Also,
I've heard everything you've said so far.
Okay. That's good. All right. I will try to do my best here. Maybe if I hook up something, it'll help. So I'm going to try to do that while I'm talking. Let me just do this. Sorry. Yeah. So all I'm saying is that it's very, very significant, very, very important that we deal with these questions as they give people the feeling that they are taken seriously. Now, just give me a moment. I'm going to my camera. Sorry. There we go. All right. Hopefully this is better. So let me know if this is any.
So if anything, it got worse, but just talk a little bit more. So, okay. So, all right, take a minute. We have a 50-minute break coming up after your talk, so we can go a couple minutes later. It's okay.
Okay. Second. One moment, sorry. I'm just trying to make it as best as I can. So one moment. Okay. We're going to try this. You'll let me know. Okay. Anyway, so the importance of the halachic, imagine a woman who's going to the hospital, right? On Shabbat to give birth. And then she asks the question about whether or not, you know, she can be taken on Shabbat. The rabbi says, of course you can be taken on Shabbat. Right? So beyond the fact that he's answering a shaila, beyond the fact that he's answering the halachic question, he's also giving the feeling, the important feeling, right, that person is understood, that their distress is understood, that what they're going through is understood,
the Judaism recognizes that. All those things are very, very important for the individual. They don't just feel like they got an answer to a question. They feel like Judaism is part of life. Judaism can relate to real life, in its context and in its place. That's really what we ask a halachic question. And therefore, answering such questions is of great, great importance. Okay, I see that they say this is worse. Okay, so
Yeah.
I'm going to try to.
Go back to the original. The original was better. Yes, I agree. All right. It's when technology goes wrong, we appreciate how great it is.
Yeah.
Like everything
Okay.
in life. Yeah.
We'll try. We'll try with this. We'll try with this. Anyway. Yes. So bottom line is that what we need to do is to relate to those issues, and it's important here for us to understand two things. Okay. Number one is that, of course, what we want to do is to make sure that people's needs are taken care of, right? And that's our first goal. Okay? And people need to feel, like I said before, what they're going through is understood by the halacha, by Judaism, by the rabbis, etc. But the second thing that we need to do is to make people feel normal. And that's a very significant point, okay? If I give someone a leniency that's too great, then what they'll feel is abnormal. What they'll feel is that their situation is out of the ordinary and not something that everybody goes through. And a lot of times people want to feel like, okay, I'm not so weird, right? And if you give someone a leniency that's too great, what they will feel is that they're not part of the community anymore. When you tell someone, right, for example, that they don't fast on Yom Kippur, that is not always a good feeling for the individual. A lot of times they will feel like, what, I won't fast on Yom Kippur? I fasted all my life on Yom Kippur. I'm not going to start fasting. They'll feel very out of place that they're not fasting. It may be something that they need to hear. It may be something that is appropriate, but it doesn't mean that for that individual, the message, right, that they're getting is a good message. So while, of course, I tell a lot of people that they shouldn't fast because of their condition, because of their situation, there's also a way to say it. There's also a certain way that we have to relate these rulings and these issues so that people understand that what they're going through is certainly normal and understandable, and that they deserve, so to speak, the ruling that they get. Bottom line, before I go into examples, right? Bottom line is that what I want people to get most of all is the same feeling that they get, as I gave ex before the example, when a woman goes to give birth in the hospital, she does not feel that the heter, that the leniency that she got, is beyond the pale. She doesn't feel like she's doing anything wrong. She understands that the halacha is taking her into account. She understands that what she's doing is completely proper and within the bounds. That's what we want. That's the kind of feeling that we want, where we want to get to, and that's the point. Okay? With all that said, and with that as an introduction, let me go into some of the questions and the answers that I've given over the war with regards to this. So, for example, right, at the beginning, there was a very significant question that many people asked about giving a hug to their husbands. Women who were in Nida were in a situation where they couldn't touch their husbands and their husbands couldn't touch them. And suddenly the husband was called away. And before he left the house, right, they wanted to know whether they could give him a hug. They didn't know when they would see him next. He was going into Gaza or in a situation where he came back from Gaza, right? And he had been away for, 3, 4 weeks. He was going to be home for 24 hours, 36 hours. Then he was going to go back. And once again, it exactly fell at the time, when the woman, when she and he were not able to touch, could they at least give, a hug, or something along those lines? It may have been important for him, may have been important for her, and what to do in that situation. So here you see the complexity, right, of such a question. Why? Because on the one hand, you might say, okay, wow, that's important. in that tenuous situation and that sensitive, environment, you'd want to maybe say that it's allowed, for someone to give just like, that one hug, just to support, both, once again, both the wife who may be at home or the husband. I mean, there were also female soldiers, of course, but both to support whoever's left, at home, or to support the individuals going out, into the field. But on the other hand, right, on the other hand, the question is whether actually giving the classic halachic answer, which is no, you're not allowed to touch, but actually give more but actually give more strength to the couple, because maybe that's what they need. Maybe what they need is a form of normalcy, meaning to say, okay, despite everything that's going on, we're going to keep this. Despite everything that's going on, we're going to be strong. We're going to keep the halacha. And not only that, and with the because of the myth of the halacha, it'll keep us safe. It'll keep us okay. What would happen if they gave a hug and then he went and then he was killed, chas v'shalom, et cetera? How would they feel? Things along those lines. You can see how delicate answering a shaila can be. It could affect people in this way. It could affect people in the other way, right? And it's not like some people might say, oh, well, the thing would be to say that they could give the hug. And certainly sometimes that is what I paskin. I'm not saying I never said that they couldn't. Certainly there were times when I felt, yes, that the situation at home was such that someone there was going to be falling apart, seriously, without that hug, and that they needed that hug to really keep things together. And if the home is holding on, then the person who goes to the front lines is holding on. A lot of times those things are related to each other, and you want to see that strength, of character, of spirit, is there. But the only way to do that is to make sure that you're evaluating the situation. Just me, I heard this psak from many, many other rabbanim over time, and I heard people who were also against the psak. I want to be honest. Not everybody agrees, that would be allowed. So it all depends on your evaluation of the situation. I agree that it's not a one size fits all, and like I said before, you have to also make the counter argument and factor that in. But with all that said, right, that's an example of how you want, on the one hand, to give strength through the halachic psak. You don't want people to feel weak or that everything's falling apart. And maybe the messaging of, yes, give the hug is, oh, you'll never see your husband again, chas v'shalom. Do you want to give over that message through the medium of the halacha? You don't always want to. But maybe that's what they need. So it's very delicate. It's very delicate. And that's the kind of thing that I meant when I said before that you want to keep in balance those two aspects. The sensitivity to the need on the one hand, but the stability of the halacha and the normalcy of the person's life, on the other, and not to make sure that you're sending the wrong message. Okay, so that's one example, and I hope that that clarifies. A second kind of question was asked regarding was asked regarding the let's say people who go out to war, whether they should sign something, right? The Aguna question came up, like what if a person, goes out to war, he disappears, they take hostages, things along those lines, right? Should soldiers sign a document that in a sense will solve the Aguna problem ahead of time? Those sorts of things, right? I had a Zoom meeting together with many other rabbanim and rabbaniyot, where this was discussed, about what to do. From a halachic perspective, there is what to discuss, surely, about what kind of document can or cannot be signed, how it should be phrased, what would solve a problem, in what case. Those are certainly halachic discussions that need to be had. And once again, with each one of these cases, I can go into the details. If people want to, I'll leave like a little bit of time at the end if someone really wants to probe me for the details. But one of the main concerns was whether it will hurt morale or not, right? Those are the questions. If you're sending a soldier into battle, you're having him sign a document that says, if, God forbid, something happens, my wife shouldn't be any good, and here's what she should do. You know, I mean, does that hurt morale in the moment? On the one hand, you want to save women from that situation. The husbands also, of course, don't want their wives to become agunas as a result of the war, and you certainly want to solve that problem. You know, on the other hand, you don't want to hurt the war effort in and of itself, right? You want to send people in with the full expectation that they will return, and not to send a message that isn't such. When we consulted with army officials on this issue, their consensus was that they should not be signing this, meaning that the better idea would be, you know, to sign it when there isn't a war. In other words, that the army should have like a policy where you can sign this thing when it's, you know, like when they're not going directly into war. Just as kind of like, you know, you get into the army and you sign something, you know, and they just do it like that. And then when it's needed, it's there. Not to sign it right before you go into Gaza or right before you go up north, you know, into a war zone. That could be something that's hurtful towards the war effort and towards the soldiers themselves. So once again, you have this delicate balance. Do you want to tend to the need, right, that's there? And of course you do. And on the other hand, is it going to hurt morale? Is it going to hurt the feeling of normalcy, the resilience, the strength people need during this time, you know, which of course is again on the other side of the equation. So that's another example, you know, of those things. I think that we also have different kinds of questions, right, that have to do with PTSD. And a lot of that is going to come out now. I think everybody's thinking about that. Trauma and trauma therapy and people will need long term. And once again, the halacha is going to be a significant part of that. We at Magle Nefesh are trying to create like a course for rabbis, a short course where we can talk to rabbis about the halachic implications and the halachic questions that come up with regards to trauma. And there are certainly many of those that can be, right? So I already mentioned one of them, for example, which is, let's say, listening to music on Shabbat. A lot of people who deal with depression, anxiety, eating disorders, PTSD, use technology in order to calm themselves down, in order to deal with flashbacks, to deal with the triggers, you know, things along those lines. And on Shabbat, a lot of times those things are just non-existent. The question is what to do in those situations. You know, I had one of the first women who ever came up to me, you know, told me that she was using technology in order to help her through her challenges. And I asked her what she was doing on Shabbat, because her question was what to do on Shabbat, but she didn't have those. So I asked, what were you doing until now? So she said until now she was either inducing vomiting on Shabbat, or she was cutting herself in a non-suicidal way. And that showed me, you know, the extent to which, you know, these kind of rulings are needed. Because people, there's no vacuum. Right. If we don't rule, if we don't paskin on these issues, if we don't give people ways that are both healthy and halakhically correct to deal with the stress that is going on, then they will turn to other ways, to other forms, in order to calm down, in order to relieve themselves of those challenges. So in that case, once again, you know, I mean, yes. Many times I tell people that they can and that they should use their phones and try to do so in a way that, of course, minimizes Chil Shabbos. Because once again, we're trying to hit sweet spot. Yeah. Where we're basically saying to the person, we want you to be able to live as a halachic, religious individual, you know, who doesn't have to give up their lives and their way of life and their principles, you know, on the one hand, but also to be able to care for your mental health. So I tell people, why don't you make a playlist from before Shabbat? You know, and you can hook up your earphones. And then all you need to do, if it's already playing from before Shabbat, is just put your earphones in your ears and take them. You don't have to press anything. You don't have to be on your phone, you know, the entire time. Hopefully it's just, you know, it's playing. It's going on its own through the playlist, you know. And in a situation like that, you know, it's much easier, you know, to allow and to take care, of yourself, of everything that's going on. Right? So those are examples, right? Like, of, let's say, dealing with PTSD and the like. Also certainly questions that we get, right? So those are one type of question that we get within Magla Nefesh. Another kind of question that we get is not strictly halachic, but rather philosophical. Okay, and I'll also spend just like a few moments on this, even though my main topic is halacha, just so that you understand. A lot of people are going through not just, and I know that I heard the end of Jenny Goldstein's presentation here, right? Some people their challenges are not halachic. They're not exactly psychiatric or psychological. They're spiritual. Okay, so they're going through some spiritual difficulties with regards to whatever challenges are going on. Why did this happen? Why does Hashem do this to me? Why did this come my way? What am I supposed to learn from this? Et cetera, et cetera. And it's what's really interesting to me is that many times what I find is that while we've thought about these things a million times, and we've always, we have in terms of the Holocaust or other tragedies that have happened to Am Yisrael throughout the ages, it's never enough. It's never enough. When you're faced with a new issue, with a new story, with a new situation, you do need to craft many times new answers to age-old questions. So questions about why did God do this to X or Y or Z, right? If they're good people, why did bad things happen to them? That may be a question that we've all pondered at times and maybe even had answers for ourselves that, put our mind to rest. But when it comes to the war, when it comes to this issue, they all come up again because we know the people, because these are individuals that live next to us. In my own community here in Beit Shemesh, four families already, lost children. So you know the people, the individuals, and the questions, they flare up again for people. And what I find, with those sorts of things is that you really can't always use a, once again, a one size fits all sort of answer. It's easier when the tragedy that you're relating to is theoretical or far away. I'll give you an example. All right. So you know that the rabbis talk, let's say, about the destruction of the first and second temple. And with the second temple, what's a classic thing to say is that the reason that it happened was because of Sinat Chinam, because of the hatred that existed between, between Jews. So that sort of answer, right, is acceptable to us because we didn't live through it, because we weren't there, right? So therefore, we don't know whether that happened or didn't. We only have the rabbi's words to take for it, right? So therefore we say, okay, I guess so, right? But I guess if we think about it for a second, well, I will say, what, did everybody who died experience that hatred? And I guess we'd say, no, probably not. Probably not everybody. There are probably some people who didn't, right? So what does it even mean when we say, oh, the reason for it was Sinat Chinam, was that hatred? It doesn't seem to compute exactly with the facts on the ground, but we don't know the facts and we don't know the people. So we can learn the lesson without having to deal with, so to speak, the fallout of that lesson of what it means for the people who actually perished, in that tragedy. But when we're dealing with the actual individuals, then of course, no answer is good, right? And so what a person needs, right, when they're going through that, is to hear not only psychological advice, not only halakhic advice, but also words of a spiritual nature that fit the situation. So to talk about the individual, to see what they lived and died for, what was important to them. Those things are usually much more comforting, also from a spiritual perspective, than generic answers, generic responses, that don't exactly fit the bill, right? So that's also a kind of thing that we're all dealing with over here from a religious perspective. I think maybe I'll pause here. I can give another few examples, but I think maybe I'll pause here. And if there are any specific questions or comments, I'll take. And if not, then I'll give you a few more examples, and we'll end with that. But I'm happy for you to guys to either ask in the chat or ask out loud. That's fine.
In the shows, I can wait till the end. I can ask you just a quick, Charlotte. How are these questions different than the COVID outbreak when people can use technology on Shabbos? And I assume there's a lot of overlap. Obviously, there are differences, of course. But I'm just curious how you would compare the Shilas now to those that began with the outbreak of COVID.
That's a great question. That's a great question. And Shilas are very similar in nature, but they're different. They're different. Why? Because with COVID, what we realized really, really quickly was that this was about to become an ongoing situation for a long time. So what needed to be done there from a halakhic perspective was basically the normalization of emergency measures. Yeah, halakhically, I'm speaking. In other words, that let's say davening outside became the norm. So therefore davening outside, but there are all kinds of problems halakhically with davening outside. Okay, we're gonna work those out. You know, people davening from porches, things like that. Those were halakhic questions. Can you join a minyan, you know, standing on a porch, you know, when everyone is downstairs, you know, et cetera. You know, those were questions that no one was really asked in a way that meant we were gonna do this for months and months and months. So what happened was that people, once again, they like normalized the emergency measure. And with the war, you assume that it's going to end quickly. It's not always true. Like in our case, also, it's not ending quickly, but many times the emergency measures are quick. They're fleeting. You feel more comfortable. Rabbis generally feel more comfortable, you know, giving, you know, like a once-off leniency on a specific issue. And saying, yeah, you can do this time, but then of course you'll go back to normal. So there is an overlap, of course, between COVID and the war, but there is a very significant difference. With the war, to some extent, you can go even further sometimes with the things that you say, because you know it's just a once off. And then everyone will go back, you know, to normal. That's not always true with other things. So that's the answer to that question, but it is definitely similar. Yes, if there's any other questions. If not, I'll give one or two more examples.
Yes, I wanted to, from my own perspective, is there anybody doing any work with halakhic problems for people with normal physical disabilities like me?
Was that a question about whether someone is doing that kind
Yeah,
of work?
I know.
Yeah, for sure. I think that definitely with physical disabilities, you know, that was done, I think, first. You know, physical disabilities were given a lot of attention right at the beginning, and now we're turning to other things, right? Which are like, you know, mental disabilities and yes, like, you know. Certainly, disabilities to do with speaking, with other things, you know, with any sort of functioning, any sort of quality of life. That stuff has been slow, but slowly but surely we are getting there. So yes, I think more and more we're seeing that. And yes, also with disabilities, like that you're talking about, there's definitely work that's being done. We do some of that work in Magdal Nefesh, and other places do that sort of work as well. So yes, absolutely. Very important. Very
Okay,
important.
you can give a couple more examples, Vakasha.
Okay, Yofi. So yes, a few more examples of things that have to do, you know, with the war. So for example, traveling on Shabbat. Traveling on Shabbat became a very big question for soldiers. I'm sure many of you have relatives, friends who are in the army, who were in the army until now. And what happens is with the roster, right, is that sometimes people, you know, they try to let people out in like small amounts to come, you know, back home. And sometimes you get out on a Friday or you get out on a Shabbos and you have to either leave on a Friday and then go back to the unit on Shabbat, or maybe you leave on Shabbos and then you have to go back on a Sunday, you know, and can you go or can't you go, right? So that's another example of, you know, a wartime shaila, you know, which many, many rabbis were receiving. Now, there was a, I can tell you from my perspective right here in Israel, it was a whole mess. It was a whole mess in the sense that we do have an army rabbinate. We have a Rabbanut Tzva'it. And I guess the most appropriate thing is for people to ask the Rav Tzva'i, the army rabbi that's connected to the unit, you know, to ask that shaila, right? So that that person gets a question, gets an answer, you know, from someone who knows the reality in the best way, right? Because that's really what we're looking for. We're looking for an answer, a response that also understands the context. And with all due respect to me and other rabbis like me, we're not in the army and we don't always know the exact reality. We also don't have the ability to converse with the mefakdim, with the commanders, you know, on the ground. So therefore, obviously that also causes you know, a disconnect. With all that said, generally, certainly at the beginning, and certainly with those who were in Gaza, the feeling is, we say in Hebrew, we say, you know, kol ha'aretz chazit, that the entire country, you know, is front lines. In other words, Israel is also a very small country, you know, but you know, it's hard to say that there's always a division that you can really make a differentiation between the front and the rear. If the rear is strong, the front is strong, and vice versa a lot of times. So therefore, going back home and visiting the family might give significant strength and support to the soldier. And therefore, yes, even traveling on Shabbat might be allowed in that situation. Once again, this was the topic of great discussion. Some rabbis were very stringent on the issue and said, absolutely not. You know, boosting morale is not, you know, something that you can violate Shabbat for. Absolutely not. And there were other rabbis who said, no, that's not true. You know, morale is part of it. And, you can bring, proofs from different places that that's so. So, you know, definitely there were different opinions. At the beginning, I think it was very justified. And the army rabbinate also came out with a basically a blanket leniency right in the first week of the war, saying that people could go and return to their homes and to their units, even if it's on Shabbat. And I think that that was absolutely correct. Not that they need my say so, but I think that that was totally justified. As the weeks went on, right, and this is what I was saying to Jay before. As the weeks went on, so there was an attempt at, like, you know, normalization according to the regular halacha. So not to we like, you know, the beginning is like very, very, like, you know, emergency-ish, right? And then later on, you know, you change it as time goes on. I'll just give one last you know, like metaphor, so to speak, for that, you know, so that you understand. It's kind of like corona, right? It's a little bit like the corona in a sense. At the beginning, I don't know how it was in the US, but certainly here in Israel, you know, when the first vaccines, right, showed up, then everybody was rushing to get them. And, there was a question of, let's say if you had your turn come up on Shabbat, could you go get it? And many rabbis said, you get the vaccine even on Shabbat. Today, if someone asked that question, they would say, wait till Sunday. Why? What's the difference? You know, the answer is that at the beginning it was viewed, you know, every moment without the vaccine was viewed by many as life-threatening. Then later, it wouldn't be seen that way. People would wait. And so we would also wait in that situation. Same thing with the war. You know, at the beginning, things are a certain way. Once you realize what the situation is, how it is, you know, then you can say, okay, it's not, you know, necessarily that stressful, and you can tweak the halacha to be a little bit of a different way. I think we're out of time, but thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll take 1 minute of questions if there are any more, or we went, but otherwise, Rav Yoni, thank you. And we look forward, as we discuss, to your book being coming out in English. I do believe it's coming out in the summer by Koren on all the shilas that come up on mental health issue, many of the questions he's been dealing with. So Yasher Koach. We will take a 15-minute break. I don't want to say Malim Bekodesh, but we really have a wonderful continuation in the afternoon. Debbie Ackerman, who put together much of the program, I want to thank her. Really phenomenal speaker. We had her at our medical ethics conference in May, which is why we invited her back here now. And Ari Sittner and Norman Blumenthal, really, these are experts in the field. So take a 15-minute break, have a quick bite to eat, and we'll resume at 12:20. You can stay on. You can put your screensaver on the web if you please. But we'll keep the program on, and we'll see you, please God, in 15 minutes. And everybody real, and thank you for joining. And okay, all right, time to get a cup of coffee, even though I don't drink coffee, but probably other people do. Okay, enjoy. Thanks.